Vermont Today. Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. When it comes to the largest city in each of our 50 states, only Charleston, West Virginia gives Burlington any competition for being the least populated largest city. But Burlington wins by having 4,300 fewer people than Charleston, so we are the wee champs. But even for its small size in relation to other big cities, Burlington does punch above its weight in attracting statewide attention. Also factor in that Burlington's former mayor made two pretty darn good runs at the presidency, and you can't help but be impressed by the attention it attracts nationally. Granted, not all that newsmaking is necessarily good. There's been quite a bit of news coming out of Burlington lately, and that's good news for Grace Ellison. That's because she's VT Digger's Burlington reporter, and she joins me now to bring us up to speed on all the news. Grace, thanks for joining me this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And listeners, if you have questions about what's happening in Burlington lately, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Grace, has this been a pretty intense time or year for Burlington, or is it just, I don't know, typical big city politics here in the BTV?
Oh, no, it's been intense. these past few weeks have been very, very busy. Leading up to the mayoral caucuses, which have determined who's going to be running in this mayor's race coming up in March. The city council has been extremely busy with some pretty contentious proposals. And now this news that came out a few days ago about this continuing saga over ex-police chief Del Pozo's Twitter account. It's been very busy lately.
And you gotta like that, though. It's good for you, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I love it. Breaking news, when the news cycle is hot, that's where I want to be.
All right, so let's start by going through the many big stories that that you've been reporting on. I want to start with policing. We'll back up to this summer when the defund the police and push for reforms movements really reached their peak in the city. So what was going on there?
Right, so over the summer, it started with the council kind of approving this controversial measure to reduce the staffing of the police department by 30% through attrition. So no one was getting fired. But they put a cap at 74 officers. When the department got down to 74 officers, then it could, hire, but it couldn't hire any more than 74 officers. And so that was, of course, in response to all of the conversations and concerns that were being expressed this summer over police brutality about, specifically people of color in our city not trusting our police forces. And so, that moved forward the way it did. And now we're kind of seeing, concerns evolve from that. In recent news that came out, John Murad, who's the current acting chief of the Burlington Police Force, saying that because the staffing is now dwindling, because people are leaving the department for a variety of reasons, they may not be able to cover the midnight shift. And so now everybody's pointing fingers, at the city council, at the mayor's office, at this new director of police transformation about, how we were supposed to address this problem before it came to this point. And so there's some disagreement happening over how that's going to be addressed. There's also a proposal that just recently passed the city council. It's a charter change proposal that's going to be going to voters in March. So it's not set in stone that it's going to be, pushed forward. But Councillor Perry Freeman introduced this overhaul to the current structure of the police commission, which is an oversight body that kind of serves as an advisory capacity to the police force. It serves as an accountability body. And so Freeman had introduced this overhaul that would give a new independent body investigatory and disciplinary power over police officers. They would be able to assess complaints that come in and make a determination about them and be able to overrule the chief of police if they don't agree with his or her final say on what happens to a cop that has a complaint levied against them. So that charter change passed the council, so it will go to voters March 2nd. If voters approve it, then it goes to the legislature. If the legislature approves it, then it goes to the governor. So charter changes take a really long time to kind of get together, but I think, you know, those are kind of the most newsworthy points around, you know, what's happened since this summer.
Well, this summer we had those protesters staying in Battery Park. They would march down to City Hall daily to protest. So are they pleased? Do they think that, you know, that their protests did indeed bear fruit for the causes that they were pushing?
Yeah, so I think, you know, directly after, you know, the protest had kind of died down was when the council had secured that buyout for Officer Bellavance, who is one of the officers who was accused of excessive force, in an incident that had happened in Burlington. There were two other officers that protesters did want to see, you know, get removed from the force. However, there are barriers in being able to do that unilaterally, you know, among labor law, among the city's charter, which, you know, had kind of turned into this police commission overhaul that I just brought up. So I think they had ended the protest at the end of summer knowing that they got one win, but also knowing that they didn't get everything done that they wanted to have accomplished. And so now that energy has kind of folded into the momentum, you know, specifically with the charter change proposal around this new police oversight body, so many people have called in advocating for this body, saying that, you know, this is what they want. The city council had dedicated one of their meetings 2 weeks ago now just to public comments because they had gotten so many people calling in. And I would say 95% of people called in to support this independent board. You know, the other 5% called in to talk about other things, but most of the people who had called in were calling in to support this new structure. So the momentum is carrying on. They got this charter change passed. Now we have to see if voters citywide agree with it and if they're down for this idea.
And that will happen on town meeting day. You had mentioned earlier there's some concerns about Burlington being without overnight police patrols. Why would that happen?
Yeah, so John Murad, the chief of police in Burlington, held a press conference about a week ago now, basically warning that the force was dwindling. And this is because they've lost a few officers to political tensions in the city. Officers just said, I don't feel supported by the city council. You know, I'm leaving. I'm not going to work here, and I'm going to go work for another public safety agency. So we've lost some officers for that reason. We've lost some officers who have retired. We've lost some officers to military deployment. And so Murad basically said, if we get down to 76 officers, we will not be able to safely and effectively staff the overnight shift that goes from 3:30 a.m. to 7:30 a.m. You know, with that being said, it is the least active shift of all of the shifts that the BPD covers. But, I mean, Murad said if an emergency happens, they might not be able to respond to it. And so, like I had said earlier, you know, there are all these people are pointing fingers right now because we knew in the summer that the staffing reduction was going to come and that it was going to cause some adjustments. And, you know, MURAD has said, hey, the city council said that when it passed the staffing reduction, it was going to hold community forums. It was going to be doing some investigative work to determine what kind of people should be staffing the BPD beyond sworn gun-carrying officers. And he said, you know, they haven't done that work yet. And so what he did is he put forward a proposal that he's been talking to the mayor about that I think there is intention to bring to the city council that would create essentially these civilian positions who deal with lower level offenses like parking tickets, and then some other positions that would deal with homelessness issues, some drug enforcement issues, who are, like I said, civilian positions. So these are not sworn gun-carrying officers. Because as Murad said, this is what has been communicated to him, that people in the community want less officers on the force. They want people to be able to deal with some lower level offenses, but are still, you know, essential for the police department to respond to. And so he put forward this proposal. Zariah Hightower, who chairs this joint committee, she's one of the council members. She chairs this joint committee that's been doing a lot of work around how to re-envision this police department, given that the staffing reduction has been put forward. She pushed back on that. She said that she's been clear from the beginning that this work to re-envision the department is going to take a long time, and that they started doing that work. They started, you know, they put together a request for proposal for these community output sessions, you know, and so she has said that she's communicated that clearly to the department. She's communicated that clearly to the mayor's office, and she said that her committee doesn't have the power to unilaterally hire or appoint people to the BPD. She said that power rests with the mayor's office, and that the mayor's office should have done something sooner to address this, you know, knowing that these staffing reductions were going to come. You know, there was no way to know how quickly these staffing reductions were going to come, given that, you know, officers are not being fired, they're leaving on their own accord. But those problems are here now. And so she pointed to Weinberger's office, and Weinberger pointed back to her. And he said, you know, you caused this problem. You passed the staffing reduction, you know, which is something that he didn't support in the beginning. So, you know, there's a whole lot of, there's contention right now about what to do with the outcome of that proposal that was passed at the point.
Contention and finger pointing. Grace, another police issue stems from a situation from mid-2019. It involved then Police Commissioner Brandon Del Pozo. So what happened at that time?
Yeah, so let's do a bit of a walkthrough on this issue because it has a lot of twists and turns. So in the summer of 2019, Burlington Police Chief Brandon Del Pozo had created this Twitter account to troll a local activist named Charles Winkleman, who had been critical of Del Pozo in the past. We now know that he had created this account on July 3rd, and on July 4th, he sent out a series of tweets targeting Charles Winkleman, and then later on that day had deleted the account. Later in July, he had gone to Burlington Mayor Murrah Weinberger and said, hey, I created this account. I lied to a 7 Days reporter who had asked me about it if I was behind it. And the next day, Weinberger put Del Pozo on administrative leave and, you know, allegedly, this is being contested now, took his gun and badge. And so in December, later on in December, this news came out. And let me just also preface this by saying that when Del Pozo was put on administrative leave, the public didn't know why. We didn't know. Weinberger was not telling reporters why was Del Pozo being put on leave. And so in December, Del Pozo came clean about this. He said, I was behind this account. I lied to a 7 Days reporter about it when I had asked about it. And then, you know, a few days later announced his resignation. When he had announced his resignation, Weinberger had then appointed then-Deputy Jan Wright to step up into the position. Later, you know, only a few hours later did we find out that Jan Wright also had an anonymous Facebook account that she used to comment on, you know, police issues on Facebook. And she had also criticized Charles Winkleman at one point using that account. And so she was then demoted back to deputy. And now John Murad stepped up, who is now the acting police chief. He had stepped up into this role. And so the more recent news around this case is that Del Pozo was recently deposed by lawyers who are bringing an excessive force lawsuit against the city for excessive force that they're alleging officers have used against men of color back in a 2018 incident. And in that deposition, Del Pozo said he had showed Weinberger the Twitter account on July 3rd, the day before he tweeted something. He showed it to him and said, hey, wouldn't this be funny, or wouldn't this be cathartic to be able to tweet back at someone who Del Pozo believes aimlessly criticizes him. And the interaction was brief. Del Pozo said in the deposition that Weinberger had kind of chuckled at it and brushed it off. And then he tweeted from it the next day and deleted the account. He had also said in that deposition that he rejects the fact that he ever gave up his gun and badge when he was put on administrative leave. But, you know, Weinberger does not agree with that in a statement that Weinberger had provided to me. And by the way, 7 Days had broken the story. So kudos to mm-hmm. 7 Days for doing some really good reporting on this. Weinberger had said in a statement to me that the interaction with Del Pozo on July 3rd was, quote, bizarre and brief. He really downplayed it, and he said that it just didn't occur to him in December when he was telling people about this account that Del Pozo had told him about. It didn't occur to him that July 3rd interaction, he said it didn't occur to him to bring it up. So voters can, you know, make of that what they will.
Why is the idea of turning in the gun and badge or not an issue at all?
Well, I think it just shows some inconsistency here. And I think it shows some, it puts voters in a weird spot of like, well, who do I believe in this instance? And it raises questions about how Del Pozo was held accountable here.
Mm. All right, so we are talking about the voters. Mayor Weinberger up for re-election in March. I remember when he ran for the first time, it was a very tight race at the Democratic caucus. Media members weren't even sure exactly how to pronounce Moreau's first name. Tim Ash was one of the candidates, and I think they had a tie, and they had to call people back to the auditorium. And then, you know, the last two have been pretty smooth sailing, though, for Moreau Weinberger. So with the things that are happening, what do you think this election looks like for him in March?
Yeah, so I think, you know, now that he's gone through two terms, this election, he's definitely more vulnerable. There's more history here for his competitors to hold against him. And, you know, the issues around policing are certainly one of them. The two kind of main competitors in this mayoral race, Ali Jiang, who is an independent council member, and Max Tracy, who is the city council president. Ali is running as an independent. Max is running as a progressive. You know, Max sent out a statement early yesterday criticizing Weinberger's not telling the public about knowing about the Twitter account on July 3rd, Ali Jiang, you know, similarly had criticisms of Weinberger's administration lacking transparency around this issue. So his competitors are certainly using this to their advantage. And yeah, so there's just more history for people to go off of here.
And this could be the strongest field that he's faced. I know Kurt Wright has run in the past, but you know, two city council members could be probably the toughest opposition he's faced in his time since being elected three terms ago.
And it's during a time when the Progressive Party has been making gains, in the city council seats. They've picked up a few in the past couple of years, and it seems like we're already seeing that momentum increasing as we're going into this election. They just, you know, the Democratic Party recently held their Democratic caucus, and one of the most interesting aspects of that caucus, because no one had contested Weinberger for the Democratic nomination, Kenan Christensen was running for the North District City Council Democratic nomination, and he had already secured the Progressive nomination for the North District Council. And Karen Durfee, who is a member of the Police Oversight Commission, she was running as a full Democrat. She was going for the Democratic nomination. She was for the North District City Council seat. She was endorsed by the incumbent of that seat, Franklin Paulino, and who is not running again. And she lost to Kenan Christensen. And so it was, you know, an interesting dynamic when the Democratic Party, you know, has explicitly told me, the outgoing chair of the party, Sam Donnelly, told me that they're playing defense this election. The Democratic Party is, you know, they know that they're up against some challengers this election. And so even in that caucus, even in their own caucus, they saw someone who had gained the Progressive nomination take a full Democratic nomination away from Karen Durfee. And so Kenan Christensen did confirm to me that he's going to be running as a DP.
We're going to take a break here, Grace. Hold on. And we're going to dig deeper into Burlington politics right after CBS News here on WDEV.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli will be putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs, Free People, Burt's Bees baby clothes, Tabitha Henry luminaries, holiday ornaments, cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly, the Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. Mayor Moreau Weinberger will be running for his fourth three-year term in March, but he faces some opposition and serious questions about handling issues from the redevelopment of downtown to policing in the city. Grace Ellison of VT Diggers, Burlington reporter. She's on with me this morning to discuss various issues in the city. If you'd like to ask Grace a question, share a comment about what you've seen in Burlington, you can call us at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Grace, Moreau comes from a development background, but the biggest project that he got behind, the redevelopment of the downtown mall, is now an unsightly hole. So give us a little background on how that happened.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, this city place development project has just hit snags for years. It just has not been able to move forward successfully. There has been a whole lot of issues behind, you know, Don Sinex, who is the main developer behind this project when it first began. He brought on this big development firm, Brookfield, that pulled out of the project, which, you know, added years on to the stalling of this project. And now Sinex is back again, although he doesn't own a majority in the project right now. There are three local developers who have come on to the project who are going to be kind of reinvigorating it. They're starting this whole new marketing campaign to get people, community members involved again, and to try to re-earn the trust of community members to say that we're going to move forward successfully this time. With that being said, the city is tied up with Sinex in legal battles. They've, you know, gone back and forth over this development agreement that the next set is just no longer applicable to the project because it's changed so much over the years. But the city is really possessive over this development agreement, I think, you know, primarily to protect itself. Weinberger has said throughout this that, you know, he has, while the project has not moved forward successfully, he's defending himself that he has worked up this agreement and this deal to protect the city financially from, you know, whatever happens with this moving forward. So the city is definitely going to be very cautious about how this development agreement evolves into a new vision because they're worried that they can't trust John Sinek again to really pull this off. So that's kind of where things are at right now.
Until this local group stepped forward, were there any local businesses really involved in the development of City Place?
No. It was Devonwood, which is the development firm that Don Sinek owns, and he had brought in Brookfield, which is this really, really big development firm to help finance this project and to move it forward. However, I just had a conversation with Don Sinek the other day for a follow-up story that we're doing on this, so stay tuned for that. He was telling me about how when the coronavirus hit, Brookfield got really nervous about the project. They were taking on a lot of acquisitions, so that's kind of his theory as to why they had eventually pulled out.
With Synex's past and problems with the city, why would these local developers, local business people, pull him back in with their group?
That's a great question. They have not responded to my interview request yet.
Okay.
So if they're listening, I have an email sent out to you guys. That's a good question. I think in what I've seen so far through their marketing campaigns that they're putting out there, they have ties to this community, ties to the state. They have a record of success in the state. You know, I think they see an opportunity here to turn this around and also to add in some local control to this project that could convince, you know, people who are nervous about the project to support it moving forward. So haven't heard it directly from them yet.
All right. We'll wait for that. Now, will City Place become Moreau what Burlington Telecom was to who was the progressive mayor?
Bob Kiss.
Yeah, Bob Kiss.
Yeah, I think he certainly doesn't want that to happen. And in conversations, you know, that he has had with reporters in the past, I mean, he has defended the fact that he propped the city up in a defensive fashion with this development agreement to keep it from, you know, losing money or losing public commitment, with the perpetual stalling of this project. So I think he would say in his defense, I've done everything I can to work with a private developer. You know, keep in mind, this Don Sinek is the private owner of this property. The city can only do so much to kind of keep him in control, right? Mm-hmm. So I think he would say, I've done everything I can. My hands are tied here. Of course, there are people who disagreed with the project from the beginning. And they'll say, you know, why did you agree to kind of bring on this corporate partner to sell Burlington to, you know, in a way. So I think people are definitely angry, but Moreau would push back that this is entirely his fault.
Let's take a look now at the progressives. They had a caucus, a contested race, and it was Brian Pine, Max Tracy. Policy-wise, was there a whole lot of difference between those two candidates?
Not really. Not really. And that's something that they both admitted. It was funny watching their, you know, quote-unquote debates. They weren't really debates. There were forums, but there really wasn't a lot of debating. There really wasn't a whole lot of difference between them about the policies that they support. The real difference between them was their experience and their leadership. Brian Pine has been involved in Burlington politics since the 80s. He worked at CETO for a really, really long time. He is known in the city as kind of a consensus builder, as someone who will cross party lines to collaborate and form consensus to get a deal done. Tracy is much more, he's a harder line progressive. He's much more wedded to his progressive principles, and he's not as likely to compromise. I'm not saying he would never compromise on anything, but he's much more harder line about his progressive principles and the progressive vision that he has for Burlington. And, so that's kind of the difference between them.
Tracy wound up winning. I think they had 1,800 people who attended the caucus via Zoom. The third candidate right now in the race is independent Ali Jiang. Where does he fit in on the political spectrum?
Yeah, so Ali is a principled independent. He's an independent counselor, and he's an independent voter and on the council. He'll frequently have unique or different takes from the counselors, that, you know, has him falling in the camp of Democrats and has him falling in the camp of progressives. So he has his following of people who appreciate and respect that principled independent perspective.
So if we had to put him on a scale, we have probably Moreau Weinberger somewhere just a little left of center, then Ali Jiang next, and Max Tracy further left after that?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it.
Are the Republicans running anyone in the race?
No, not that I've seen, which is definitely different than other political dynamics in other cities. In Burlington, the divide is really between Democrats and progressives.
Which could split the ticket, so wouldn't this be the opportunity that Kurt Wright has always wanted to finally become mayor of Burlington?
It's a good point. It definitely could split the ticket, especially with having Ali Jiang in the race as an independent.
Right.
I haven't talked to Kurt recently. Do you know if he's thinking about running?
Well, you know, I live right near the radio station he's working at, and so every once in a while I bump into him. I'll have to ask him next time I see him. Maybe I'll put a bug in his ear. This could be his opportunity. I know he's doing a morning show right now, so maybe he just digs getting up at 3 a.m., but he's always wanted to be mayor. Is the Burlington GOP even a thing right now?
Not that I've really seen. I came into this role in September, so I am still getting accustomed to this Burlington beat, but not that I've seen.
And I think you mentioned earlier there are no council members, Republican council members right now. Is that correct?
Exactly. There's, six progressives, one independent, five Democrats. So the progressives do have a majority right now.
Well, Burlington has long been a bastion of progressive politics, but is it tilting further left these days?
Like I said earlier, the Progressive Party is definitely gaining momentum, and with that momentum comes the power to move policy proposals forward that wouldn't move forward if there was a Democratic majority on the council. So we are seeing some really interesting ideas coming forward. One of, a great example of this is the charter change proposal to create a independent investigatory and disciplinary police oversight body that's going to charter change vote in March. That is really a progressive idea, and the progressive support really got it passed the finish line. It drew ire from some of the Democratic members who have a more pragmatic approach to policy building. I wouldn't say that the Democratic members of the council disagreed with the overall premise, but there needs to be some more accountability focused toward the Burlington Police Department. But they had issues with it. some of the issues being There's no detailed budget for an oversight body like this. There's no required training for the people on the board to be able to investigate police officer complaints. So there are pragmatic issues coming from Democratic members about some of these policies put in court, and it creates a very interesting political dynamic in Burlington, because there are these progressive ideals moving forward that, you know, those left of center are kind of halfway behind. They support them, but some of the more radical elements of them, they don't fully support.
Well, let's look at a few more of these. I think another one is eviction protection that the progressive part of the council has pushed and passed.
Right. And that did get a little bit more Democratic support. There were a couple of Democrats who voted against that, but that did have more support from Democrats in the city. What this proposal does, so essentially in Vermont right now, any renter can be evicted without cause. So even if your rental agreement expires, if you can be evicted for essentially any reason.
Right.
But under this proposal, you would only be able to be evicted if you break rental laws, if you are unable to pay your rent, or if you break the lease agreement for any reason. There are some exceptions that were added into the proposal to quell some concerns from people in the city, like, well, what if I want to put my home up for sale, or what if I want to take it off the rental market and I can't evict my tenants? What do I do with my property that I own? Those exceptions were added into the charter change proposal. But, yeah, so that was also passed at the city council, and so that will also be on the March 2nd ballot for people to vote on.
And does Burlington already have some kind of controls in place about how much someone renting can be charged at the outset instead of first, last, and security? I think it's just first and security. Does Burlington have that as well?
Exactly. So there is a restriction that Burlington landlords cannot ask for a last month of payment. And I think Brattleboro is passing something like that as well.
Yes, Burlington and Brattleboro are the twin cities right now. They seem to kind of really be of the same mind. I'm going to ask you about one more that I believe has come from kind of the progressive side of the city council in Burlington, and I think that's the retirement fund divestment.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yeah. That passed a few weeks ago. That resolution, which was led by Jane Stromberg, she was a heavy proponent of that, and that gained a good amount of support from Democratic members as well. This was a few weeks ago, so my memory is a bit fuzzy on that. But that's another really interesting idea, something that has been talked about in the city for a long time. That passed more easily because of the progressive momentum behind it. So yeah, that's another good example of kind of the tides changing in Burlington right now.
We don't have a ton of time left, but what will you be looking at on town meeting day in Burlington, Grace?
Yeah, so what I am most excited about is getting an answer on town meeting day about the pulse of Burlington's electorate. Because right now, there are a lot of people, specifically in the progressive camp, who are being very loud about police reform, about supporting a progressive candidate like McCarthy. And so there are, because of that camp is very loud right now, we don't necessarily know if the argument that Weinberger is pushing forward, that people want someone who can take them out of a financial crisis like he did when Bob Kitts was mayor with the Burlington telecom disaster. We're really going to get an answer on March 2nd about how this electorate is feeling about a lot of these issues that are defining our politics of the day, with COVID-19, with policing issues. That's what I'm most excited to learn from the outcome of this election.
Do you ever get bored covering this beat?
Not at all. I have the best job ever.
I can tell. You seem very energized, and I would never guess that you've only been on it, you know, full-time since September. You've got it really covered well and really explain it well, so thank you. That's Grace Ellison. She's VT Digger's Burlington reporter. Grace, I want to thank you for taking the time, the full hour, to give us this comprehensive look at the top stories happening there.
No problem. Thank you so much for having me.
CBS News is next. Then we'll be back to get a national news update from correspondent Bob Ney. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli will be putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs, Free People, Burt's Bees baby clothes, Tabitha Henry luminaries, holiday ornaments, cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly, the Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. Every Friday morning at this time, we get caught up on all the top stories from around the world with great insight from correspondent Bob Ney. Bob, great to have you back with us again.
Well, thank you, Rick.
Bob, we always take a look at the COVID numbers first, and I guess, boy, the vaccine hitting... getting out there, rolling out just at the right time. So let's take a look first at what we're seeing with the COVID numbers.
Sure. Globally, the total deaths are 1,660,032. And then in the United States, the total deaths are 310,325, Rick. So if you look at, you know, the total deaths worldwide and the total deaths in the United States, we're pretty high.
Yeah.
And I had taken a look actually at a data tracker on COVID. The highest states are Tennessee, then you go down about five states to Ohio, and you've got Vermont down towards the bottom at 16 per 100,000 in the last 7 days. So it's interesting to look state by state. Of course, the number one state hotspot in the country is California.
Right. And it should be noted that Vermont, for a long time, we were around 59 deaths, I think, for about a month. We have now shot up over 100 in probably the last month or so. So it really has escalated. I mentioned the vaccines. So, so far, how are things rolling out with the vaccine here in the U.S.?
Well, probably today, Moderna is going to be approved because the advisory board approved it of the FDA, Rick, and that usually doesn't rubber stamp, but usually that means that the FDA itself is going to do something and probably will today on an emergency basis. Moderna is also being looked at as a great sort of, I don't want to say complete alternative, but as a decent way for rural America to be able to get the vaccine out there because it doesn't have to be stored at the minus 91 degrees that Pfizer does, the vaccine. So both are very effective, you know, in the test studies of the rates. But that means that another 100-some million, and then Moderna has contracted, I think, with 200 million with the United States government. Pfizer, 100 million, because for some reason the government didn't contract the other 100 million at the time. So that takes us to basically 300 million doses, Rick. I think we would need probably eventually 500 million doses because, of course, when you say 100 million doses, that's enough for 50 million people. You have to get two shots.
That's right. So that's the U.S. How are things rolling out in the rest of the world? I know Britain, Germany are having success in rolling it out. The U.S. Anywhere else in the world that they're having this? I think Russia might.
Russia and also Israel. Israel, you know, has been rolling it out. The areas that people are worried about are more like, you know, the African nations, the third world countries, you know, how they'll be able to do it. For example, I travel to India a lot, and just thinking about India and its areas and trying to get electricity and, you know, storage capacity for a vaccine that would have to be minus 95 is going to be really, really tough. But They're at least trying now worldwide to do something. They think that 1/4 of the world will get a vaccine, get a vaccine until 2022.
Oh, my.
Because they're taking into account the extreme remote areas, Rick, of the world and the tough areas.
And generally, Bob, what percentage of the population really needs to get the vaccine for it to be effective for that herd?
Herd immunity.
Yeah, immunity.
Yeah, they were saying that Dr. Fauci, I'd rather quote him than anybody, I think, and they were saying like it has to be around 70%. And then, of course, as we reach that 70%, which I think we will once a certain amount of people get vaccinated, that'll bring along other people who don't want to, who are afraid to, you know. But then you've got the whole world, because obviously airlines will open up again and transportation. So the rest of the world needs to do it, too. And it's a little discouraging to see it's going to take till possibly 2022. But, yes, you need to achieve that 70% some figure inoculated.
Well, another thing that's tied to all of this is indeed the stimulus package. This has been kicked around since sometime this summer. Are we getting any closer there in Washington to an actual stimulus package?
Well, we are. And what's interesting, Rick, is that White House staff intervened Thursday, just yesterday, to prevent President Trump from issuing a public statement saying that the check should be $2,000, which he was going to do, which would have really thrown Washington upside down probably at the last minute. But right now there's a check in the package of $600 per person that Congress has come to seems agreement on. I would have said, well, which we did, you and I talked probably last month about how it didn't look good, but I would say now it's looking better, and they're trying to get a package before they let them go home. So I think it's around the corner.
And Bob, is this just one step? Is there another package that needs to happen after this, or could we see another 6 or 9 months of this, of things being kicked back and forth before we see more money coming to states and people?
Well, you know, that's a great question, because you've got the transition of a new president, and so you've got Congress doing, part of something. The stimulus was, I think, needed to go directly, to citizens, but they're doing part of something, and the unemployment. So I assume what's going to happen now, everything's going to be a little bit on hold for future bills until, Joe Biden is sworn in as president. The administration gets up and going. Then at the same time, ironically, you have all these vaccinations. So how does that impact? Do things start to go back to normal? Do they need as big of a package? And what do they do about small business? So I think it's probably a 3 or 4 month wait and see. Mm-hmm. And then we'll know a lot more. So I don't expect anything pushed right away after Biden is sworn in, for obvious reasons we just talked about.
Yep. Speaking of Joe Biden, what do you make of his nominees so far to fill his cabinet?
Well, I think that they've been pretty good nominees. He has placed some people in there that are sort of firsts, with, some females and also minorities. If you look overall at the cabinet, he sort of played safe in the sense that it's sort of Joe Biden from the Senate, and I always say this because I served with, Joe Biden, of course, in Congress.
Right.
But there's the Joe Biden, the moderate, and then there's the Joe Biden, the sort of moderate-leaning progressive that beat the progressives, in the Democratic primary. And now you've got Joe Biden, the president-elect, who kind of went back and, picked some of the Obama people and picked some of the more, quote, moderate element. Especially for the inside staffers. So I think that he's probably going to be, I would say, more of a centrist.
Now, these nominations have to be approved, and you've been through this, Bob. You know what goes on. So how does it look, from your perspective of how things will be when he has to get these nominees approved?
Well, what's going to be fascinating to see is what happens in Georgia. Does it end up a 50-50 tie? in the Senate? Does it end up the Republicans still control the Senate by one vote, or do they control it, you know, by two votes? So that's going to be interesting to see. If it's a 50-50 tie, gives Biden a lot more leverage. But even if it's not, I mean, I'm just looking down the list of the nominees, and for the most part, I think it's going to be hard for the Republicans to reject a lot of the nominees. I really do. I don't think that there are nominees that people will look at and say, oh, my goodness, you know, how on earth could they be nominated? Now, Pete Buttigieg, you know, who ran in the Democratic primary, he's been criticized because he doesn't have a lot of transportation experience. But Buttigieg will make it through the process, too, because, you know, he's capable. He's, you know, he's been a mayor. He'll have a good staff. So even where they'll criticize them having not as much experience, Rick, I think it's going to be hard for the Republicans to, en masse, just vote down the nominees of Joe Biden.
So when it comes time for the inauguration, how different will it be this year from inaugurations of the past?
This is it. This is going to be the most different inauguration probably in American history, he's going to the president-elect's going to have limited personal attendance due to the COVID. It's going to look more like a State of the Union, very limited tickets. A member of Congress gets one ticket and one additional ticket. When I was in Congress, believe me, you could get 78 or 80 tickets or more, you know. And so that's all they're going to get. And then they're trying to ask people to stay home, stay away from the ceremony. That's what they're encouraging. So this is going to be more enhanced online viewing. It will be the most different inaugural that we have seen, at least I would assume, since the Civil War.
A big question is a particular guest and a plus one. Will we see the sitting president and Melania joining?
Wow. You know, I surely hope so, but at this point in time, they're mum on it,
yeah,
whether they're going to do it or not. It's happened before in not too many cases, I think three or four, if my memory serves me right, at the most, for different reasons. But I would surely hope it happens, but we just don't know yet.
Yeah.
We're waiting to hear the official word.
Well, another big thing that happened this week in Washington was the cyber attack. So tell us about that, and is it worse than was originally thought?
Absolutely worse. This one is, you know, when the United States government uses the words grave, then there's a problem. They went in and they breached the Departments of Defense, State, Homeland Security, Treasury, Commerce and Energy, and the National Nuclear Security Administration. They breached 40-some major companies. They also did it in England, Israel, United Arab Emirates, Canada, Mexico, Belgium, and Spain. So this was, you know, done in different parts of the world, done worldwide. But the United States government believes that at least in March this breach started. They sound the alarm this Sunday, but they're saying in March it started. I think it's major. Here's something we have to consider. Once they find out, you know, how this was done, did they install backdoors, as they call them, where they can come back in and get information later? What information did they retrieve? Codes, you know, installations, you name it, they could have gotten it. And that means, Rick, that most likely once we find out as a government, we have to recreate all those platforms to take everything offline and put it onto a new platform, which could be, I mean, a monumental, terribly expensive undertaking. No question about it. This is a biggie.
We've heard it's the Russians. So these must be some brilliant people, first of all, whomever did it. But do we know anything about who would have created such a breach, who would have been able to get in there?
Well, U.S. Cybersecurity and our Infrastructure Security Agency, that's part of Homeland Security, said yesterday that the intruder was, quote, demonstrated sophistication and complex tradecraft, which is kind of code for it was from a government. Just as we had the anthrax on Capitol Hill years back, it was government-grade anthrax. There's a difference between kind of civilian-created and government-grade. And the same thing with this. There's hackers, and there's some bright hackers around the world, but they are saying this one was so sophisticated and the tradecraft, which I think they're kind of indicating it was governmental and indicating it was, you know, most likely Russia.
I always feel so much brighter, so much more brilliant at about this time every Friday. Bob Ney, thank you for your perspective on these stories that are shaping our world.
Have a great weekend.
All right, you too. Dr. Jane Kim is the Chief Consultant for Preventive Medicine at the Department of Veteran Affairs, and she joins me now to discuss the VA's plan to vaccinate millions of veterans and thousands of employees across the country. Dr. Kim, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Hello there, and thank you for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So, Dr. Kim, what is the VA's plan for vaccinating its veterans?
Well, we kicked off this week with vaccinations on Monday, which was a thrilling moment. The first person to receive vaccine in our VA system was a World War II female veteran in Massachusetts. So that was just incredible for all of us to see. Since Monday, we have continued on with vaccinating our highest risk healthcare personnel, as well as our veterans who live in our long-term care facilities. So our plan after this week is to continue on with vaccinations next week and after New Year's of additional staff and veterans at highest risk. We hope as we get more supply, probably after New Year's, to offer vaccine to our veterans who are at high risk for severe illness from COVID, including our veterans who are older in age, as well as those who have medical conditions that put them at high risk.
And Dr. Kim, I'm sure veterans, non-veterans, all of us are wondering, from your perspective, what are you able to tell how safe the vaccine is?
I know safety has been on a lot of people's minds with these COVID vaccines because the process of developing them has gone very fast. I will say, though, that no steps were skipped in the development of the Pfizer vaccine or the Moderna vaccine or of any of the other vaccines that are currently in development. All steps were carefully gone through with safety and effectiveness checks at multiple time points to make sure that the vaccine was safe and effective. And it certainly is, based on the scientific data. These vaccines were studied in tens of thousands of people and are safe and effective in protecting people against COVID disease. I got my vaccine yesterday at the Durham VA as a primary care provider.
Congratulations.
I'm sore, but my arm is better. So I would say I would recommend it to others, including my family and my patients.
Will the VA be receiving both Pfizer and Moderna?
Yes, we are waiting to hear from the FDA as soon as today about whether they will authorize the Moderna COVID vaccine. So if that happens, we have planned to roll out that Moderna vaccine to a large number of our medical facilities across the VA network in the United States. And so once that happens, we will have much more reach in terms of our vaccines across the country. And after New Year's, when we anticipate there will be even more vaccines manufactured, we hope to extend that even further to our clinics where a lot of veterans receive their care.
I know the Moderna vaccine can be shipped at lower temperatures, or higher temperatures, I guess, than 90 below zero. So will that kind of impact where you send that as opposed to the Pfizer vaccines?
Yeah, certainly the fact that the Moderna vaccine can be stored at a conventional freezer capacity is a huge bonus for sites who may not have the ultra-cold freezer that the Pfizer vaccine needs. So we do have a large number of our medical facilities who have a conventional cold freezer that is ready to store the Moderna vaccine. So that plus having a good supply of Moderna vaccine will make it possible for us to ship that vaccine and have it safely stored in many of our facilities across the country.
Now, I know you said that the veterans who are in VA facilities are receiving the vaccine first. What about other veterans? How are they being prioritized?
Sure. So because vaccine is in short supply initially, we have worked and will continue to work with the CDC to make sure that those who are offered vaccine first are those who are at highest risk for developing COVID or potentially giving it to others. So after our frontline healthcare personnel and our veterans living in our long-term care facilities have opportunity to get it, the next people who may get it are those who are at highest risk. Among our veterans, those are the older veterans and ones with medical conditions. The CDC actually will decide on that this weekend, I believe, and so we'll wait to see what happens with that and align with them with their recommendations.
How long might it take to have all the veterans vaccinated against COVID-19?
Oh, that's a good question about how long it'll take to get the veterans to all the veterans a vaccine if they would like it. I would guess sometime next year in 2021, there will be a lot of vaccines available from not just Pfizer and Moderna, but possibly even other manufacturers to make that COVID vaccine available widely throughout the United States. When exactly that will happen, I am not sure, but from what I'm hearing, there will be millions more doses in 2021.
Now, I know some people are leery of vaccines, but from a medical standpoint, are there any reasons why someone should not or would not get a vaccine, get this vaccine?
For the vast majority of people, the COVID vaccines are safe. There is really no reason to be concerned about a severe adverse event after the COVID vaccines. These vaccines were studied in tens of thousands of people, and there were no significant safety concerns to prevent the FDA from authorizing them. That being said, there is a small subset of people who may have had a severe allergic reaction to an ingredient of the COVID vaccine. The one that's currently out is the one from Pfizer. So if that is the case, they should not be getting the Pfizer vaccine. But again, that's a very small subset of people. And for the vast majority of us, it is safe.
Are there any major differences if you had the opportunity to get Moderna or you had the opportunity to get Pfizer, you know, to have a choice to know that one might be better for an individual or not?
You know, the interesting thing is with the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, they are both a similar technology made out of mRNA. And it is just fascinating that they are coming in really close in terms of how well they work to protect against COVID disease and their safety. So it is just a remarkable thing that you have two vaccines coming out, potentially, if the FDA authorizes Moderna, almost at the same time with similar safety and efficacy. They're both two doses as well. The time interval between the two is different slightly, but really close in terms of safety and efficacy.
You're absolutely right. It is absolutely amazing. I think even a few months ago, we thought it could be sometime, you know, next year that we'd have these vaccines. So it really is phenomenal that it's happening right now. Pretty exciting time. What else should people know, Dr. Kim?
Sure. So I think the thing to know is that if veterans would like to get more information on COVID vaccines, if they're veterans, they can go to va.gov, sign up there on the COVID vaccine hub, and we will be in touch about COVID vaccines as we get more supply and as it's their turn.
Well, I want to thank you so much. Dr. Jane Kim is the Chief Consultant for Preventive Medicine at the Department of Veterans Affairs. It's been a pleasure speaking with you this morning. And again, congratulations on being able to get the vaccine.
Likewise. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Take care, Dr. Kim. This is Vermont Viewpoint, and I want to tell you a little something about what I hope to do here in the future on this program. I'm hoping to launch a Friday feature soon that allows you, listeners, to come on and tell me about someone who is a real asset to Vermont, someone who has accomplished something great in their lives, or who dedicated years to your community and Vermont, made Vermont a much better place. So think about somebody like that and let me know. You can email me, Rick Singeri. I'm at vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com, and we'll chat a little and then hopefully have you on the air some Friday to really praise someone who has done something great here in Vermont. We're going to take a break for a CBS News update, and then we're going to be back in just a few minutes to speak with Kathy Resmer of 7 Days, and she's found some great stuff that we can all be happy about from 2020. No, really. I'm telling you, great stuff. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli will be putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs, Free People, Burt's Bees baby clothes, Tabitha Henry luminaries, holiday ornaments, cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly, the Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
This is Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. And all I can say is thank goodness for Kathy Resmer. 2020 is the crappiest year on record. No recount is needed. The vote wasn't even close. Now, the dinosaurs might argue that the moment they went extinct was pretty horrendous, and all living plant life that existed as the Ice Age began might disagree, but they didn't get their ballots in on time, so... But 7 Days deputy publisher Kathy Resmer has written a piece that you might want to keep around to reread every time you need to smile and feel good and believe that things really will be all right. It focuses on the good things that have happened in 2020. And Kathy Resmer joins me now. Kathy, thank you for being on the show and for writing this piece.
Rick, thanks so much for having me. I do want to correct that, just to note that I did write elements of this piece, and I wrote a lot of it. But it was definitely a team effort with our whole staff sort of looking out for stories and chiming in and offering to write different parts of it. And everybody, of course, who was writing it, turned in their work and said, that was really great. I really loved writing
that. Oh, that's fantastic. So, and they all got it in on time, right? They all hit their deadlines? That's so great.
Yeah, yeah. I know, that was good.
Hey, listeners, yeah. I wanted to ask listeners, if you want to let us know about good stuff that happened this year, you can call us at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Kathy, has there been, as you were putting this together, has there been this sense that you found that we're all in this together more than usual, so let's really make this as good a time, a good year as we possibly can?
I mean, I think there's definitely a sense of that, but I think that I know most folks, a lot of folks I know who are struggling right now, and it is a really challenging time, especially if you're a parent also, or if you're someone who's immunocompromised, or if you're isolating at home, it can feel really overwhelming. Mm-hmm. I know parents of young kids I know so many of them who are really struggling. But I do see though and hear from lots of people who are talking about good things that happen, and sometimes those get lost.
Yep.
In the way that we report the news. Actually I had the idea for this cover package back in November. One of the things that has gotten me through this whole time is walking,
mm-hmm,
like
yep.
every day, at least one or two times a day,
totally.
When I'm also walking outside. And I'm always listening to a podcast or talking to somebody on the phone. And I was listening to, I really love the podcast Hidden Brain. Hmm. I don't know if you've ever heard that. It's a show on NPR. I highly recommend it, but it's about the hidden things that are happening in your brain, and the topics are always really interesting. This episode, though, that I was listening to is called Beyond Doom Scrolling. Are you familiar with that term, doom scrolling?
No, it scares me.
Yeah. Well, doom scrolling is the act of, it's something that people are doing a lot, I think, right now. They've got their phones, and they're just scrolling through headlines. And for a while there, like right at the beginning of the pandemic, I think all of us were feeling like, what is the new news? Like, oh, my God, more cases. Oh, my God, more, as it gets worse and worse, and then there's the election, and then there's, all kinds of different things happening, wildfires in California,
right.
all over. And so you're scrolling on your phone, and some of the things, like if you're scrolling on Facebook, for example, it doesn't ever hit the bottom. It doesn't stop.
Right.
right?
Yeah.
And your phone is built to keep you on it and to keep you scrolling. And so there's this feeling of dread, this endless loop of negative news that you're just, you know, seeing headlines for, this doom scrolling. And so this episode of Hidden Brain that I was listening to had psychologist Steven Pinker on it. And he was talking about psychologically why it is so hard to see that there actually are a lot of good things happening and positive trends. But that the way that we think about and we recognize news, it's often focused on conflict and what is the latest threat or the thing we need to be alert for.
Yeah.
And so just thinking about, you know, he was talking about how do we help people recognize some of the good things that are happening. And I thought in my head, I thought, oh my gosh, that's perfect. We should talk about some of the good things because there are good things happening.
Well, let's go. I'm going to start throwing out topics and you can tell me some of the things. And we're going to start with my favorite, food.
Oh, food. Yes. well, there, as I said in the intro to that section, there's just been a lot of negative food news, mostly just about hunger and rising rates of hunger. Yeah. But one of the really positive things that I have seen, first of all, the efforts like shift meals and frontline foods and everyone eats, there are all these new innovative programs that have popped up over the last 9-10 months that both put restaurant employees to work and help them feed the Vermonters who are in need of food. And that's been really interesting to watch. We've reported on a few different ones. There was this one program early on in the pandemic that they've stopped fundraising for it locally, but it's called Frontline Foods. And the idea was they raised like $160,000 locally for this effort. And what it was it was paying local restaurants to prepare and deliver food to frontline workers as a way of saying thank you. And so they had, you know, all these restaurants who were trying to, you know, their local businesses, they're trying to stay afloat. They, you know, people were giving this money to the restaurants to then make food for the nurses over at University of Vermont Medical Center or the first responders in their community. So that was a pretty cool thing that happened. I mean, that was not something that was happening prior to the pandemic. Just, you know, there was this need and people sort of organized to fill it. Another thing I thought was really interesting was it was a UVM COVID-19 food insecurity study that was just released in November. And one of the findings, I mean, the really alarming findings, right, are that one in three Vermonters called themselves food insecure or defined themselves as food insecure between May and or March and September, I think, which is a staggering number.
It is a staggering number.
And that includes people who have accessed food assistance, but also people who have gone without meals to save money or stretched their meal budget or bought cheaper and less nutritious food to save money.
Yeah.
So there was that. But there was this really great finding that said that 40% of Vermonters have delivered food to someone in their community during the pandemic. And that, I think, is really interesting because you've got people, you know, there are people who are suffering, but there are also people who they can help, and they are. They're stepping up and volunteering to go get groceries for someone. There are all these mutual aid groups that have popped up all over Vermont, and some of them are not no longer active, but early in the pandemic they were very active, and some of them still are. But doing things for neighbors, like checking on elderly neighbors in rural areas, picking up some groceries for someone. You know, if there's they need a little extra this month, do they have to rent or pay the utility bill? You know, people are recognizing this need, the people who are falling through the cracks, and they're sort of stepping up to help in those situations, I think.
Yeah.
Which is, that to me has been really inspiring to watch.
There have been organic little things like Handy's Lunch, a couple $1,000s given by people to, like you said, help feed frontline workers, to help feed kids who are at summer camp, which was really neat. I love the, in this story, there's the little free pantries where people put some non-perishable items in what were like little free library boxes. And there's a great picture. What makes me very happy, I'm going to smile every time I see this picture. It was taken by Sally Pollock, and you can see her reflection in the glass, which is another happy little moment for 2020. Take a look. I'm speaking with Kathy.
I noticed that.
Yeah. You're going to love it. Kathy, I'm going to give you the opportunity now to pick a topic and take us somewhere on something good that was found.
Okay, I can't resist saying, first of all, WDEV, oh my gosh, thank you for what you do.
Oh,
for being so great.
Thanks.
I just was hearing the ads, you know, and one of the things that I think is so great that we do point out in this piece is that something that we've seen that's been really positive this year is that Vermonters are supporting the things and institutions they love locally. And I listened to all of those ads and I'm thinking, I got to go buy stuff at Stowe Street Emporium. I got to support Nelson's. Oh my gosh, what a clever ad.
Mm-hmm.
It's a poem. It's so funny. You know, all of these local businesses are, you know, they are the things that make our community special. They're one of the things that are the, you know, they're what distinguishes our communities.
Yes.
And we've just seen Vermonters supporting businesses that they love. We have this Give Local giveaway contest that we did through 7 days to encourage readers to buy local. We had bunches of people responding to us, telling us why they're buying local. And then in almost all of the business stories that we've written during the pandemic, a theme throughout is that the customers of those local stores are keeping those stores alive.
Beautiful.
And, you know, I think that, and for us, I don't know about you, it's WDEV, it sounds like you're also seeking contributions from listeners.
Yep.
You know, at 7 days, our paper's always been free, our website's always been free. We've never needed to ask readers for money. And this year, for the first time, we have said, hey, if you like what we do, we need you to support us right now. Because we lost like half of our advertising revenue when the pandemic shut everything down. And that's what's been funding our journalism. And it's been really amazing to see, we've had more than 2,000 readers step up and contribute to us and to just give us monthly a recurring donation of like $7 a month or $10 a month. And, you know, just thinking, wow, people really do care about what we do and it matters.
Yep.
So that's been something really important. And I think people have seen that. I've seen that happening all over the state, and different people that you talk to, different business owners you talk to say, our customers are coming through for us. So that's a really positive thing.
I love it. Hey, let's take a quick call. We've got Fred in Newbury calling in. Fred, I hope you got something really good from 2020 for us.
Yeah, I do. COVID-19 gave the American people and the Vermonters a first-class lesson on how powerful weapons of mass destruction are.
Huh. Well, that is one way of looking at what we have indeed been experiencing. I guess, a virus of this type definitely is a weapon of mass destruction in a way. Kathy, there's a lot of what you have, or some of the items that you have, come from a part of 7 Days Kids VT, a great publication.
Yeah.
It's the Good Citizen Challenge. So please tell us about that.
Sure. The Good Citizen Challenge is a youth civics initiative that we started 7 Days in Kids Vermont, our parenting publication. We started it in 2018, and the idea back then was that we saw that America's really divided. We thought, what do all of us have in common? Well, we all have our system of government in common, and there are some basic civics knowledge that I think that were a lot of people that didn't understand then, and I think people understand a little bit better now because of the election year that we've just been through. So people have learned a lot about the Electoral College, for example, how that works, and I think that... So back in 2018, we were thinking, oh, we want people to be able to name the three branches of government. We want people to be able to name what are the five freedoms in the First Amendment, because there are five distinct freedoms in that very First Amendment to our Constitution that are the bedrock of, of our democratic society. You know, free speech, freedom of religion. Let's see if I can do all five really quick. Free speech, freedom of religion, freedom of assembly, freedom to petition the government for redress of grievances, and one of the most important, freedom of the press. right?
Right.
So those are five freedoms. And so we started this Good Citizens Challenge to get kids to think about these things. Then, you know, during COVID and during the last few months, we thought, well, we could use the challenge to give kids and families and adults something to do during this winter when we're all going to be spending a lot more time at home. So we came up with the Good Citizen Challenge. It has all kinds of activities in it that you can do. There are history, government, news literacy, and community service activities. So you and your kids, the kids in your life, can do an activity. Send it to us on our website, goodcitizenbt.com, and you'll be entered into a drawing for various prizes, like gift certificates to local bookstores. I think we're also going to be raffling off on December 30th a gift subscription, a one-year subscription to The Week magazine.
Oh, yeah.
Which is really great.
Nice.
So, you know, and the activities are things like, one of them is shovel snow for a neighbor. make some thank you cards for essential workers. You have some, there's like a Vermont Historical Society is doing this Vermont trivia nights, virtual trivia in January on Wednesday nights.
Mm-hmm.
So you could take part in that and get, earn some points in the challenge. So there's lots of different activities to do, and all of them are able, you're able to do them remotely. And it's just a fun way to encourage people to do, to pass the time productively over the next few months.
All right.
So that, you can find all of them at goodcitizenvt.com.
Give that again, goodcitizenvt.com. Excellent. All right, Kathy, about 30 seconds left. One more thing I got to say that was great for 2020. Tell us about cocktails to go.
Oh, yes. Come on. I mean, who doesn't love that? That's got to be, we got to make that permanent.
I know.
I mean, that I went and got one from the distillery in Montpelier, Bar Hill Gin.
Right.
That distillery there, oh, my gosh, I couldn't believe it. It was the cutest little cocktail thing that they had in a bottle with a little stopper in the top of it. I brought it home, and, oh, that was just fantastic. I don't ever want to lose that.
One of the many things to love about 2020. Kathy Resmer is the deputy publisher of 7 Days, and she and the staff have done The Near Impossible. They have taken the greatest of all positive spins on the worst year in the world's existence. So thanks to you and everyone at 7 Days for that.
Thanks so much for having me on, Rick.
All right. And that's it for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Taylor Dobbs, directed by Danny McIvrigan, and our email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. I'm Rick Singeri, and I'll meet you back here on Monday.